Chris Padgett made his professional debut at the age of just 16. So what we talk about here in this podcast episode is the difficulties acclimatising to that environment, as well as the challenges of trying to come back for that difficult second season after starting. And Chris talks very honestly about the demands of professional cricket, as well as the ways he's had to adapt when leaving the sport, and now to the point where he can reflect on what he learned from that experience, and how the things over the years have impacted both his physical and mental health. Chris now runs a charity called Milestone, which I'd encourage anyone to check out and get involved with. This conversation is very honest, very reflective, but also plenty of positives to take from it. Okay, Chris, as we chat this afternoon, like any good story, I suppose, it's good to go back to the start. But for yourself, the start in terms of professional cricket is a heck of a lot earlier than we might expect for others. So just briefly talk me through how you got to be in that position to play first-class cricket so young.
Yeah, it happened really quickly, truth be told. I was at school at Repton, which is on the kind of Staffordshire-Derbyshire border. I'd always been a decent enough cricketer. I'd never played any, I'd never represented any of the international sides during the age groups or anything like that. But I got approached during the winter of kind of 2003, and was asked to go along and effectively, I suppose, trial at the academy. There wasn't a formal trial period, and went along and things went quite well, and I obviously did enough to impress, and then got invited to come along and bowl at the first team in pre-season, and yeah, off the back of that I got offered a summer contract, actually on the first day of my GCSEs. Which was amazing, but probably not the best timing. As a 16-year-old, I got slightly distracted, I think. But I then joined up with the squad pretty much as soon as I'd finished school. I was kind of going along and training with them. I wasn't on the academy at this point, so I'd kind of signed a contract before I was officially on the academy, and just lapped up and loved every minute of it. It was the first real taste that I'd had of men's cricket, in truth. I'd played a bit of kind of club cricket, but most of the cricket I played had been junior representative cricket for Staffordshire and school cricket. So yeah, I just had a good run of form. I think I bowled quite nicely. I definitely benefited from the fact I couldn't drive. I'd get dropped off at the ground at kind of 8:30 in the morning, and bless my parents, they would drive from Staffordshire, from basically just outside Stafford. So it's a good 45 minutes to an hour drive there. And then they would drive themselves back and go to work, and then I would wait to be picked up. So I just lived and breathed cricket. And I benefited from the fact that Derbyshire weren't a strong county. So yeah, just kind of mucked in and played some second team cricket, did okay, and then got a call, kind of nudge from Dave Houghton, who was the coach at the time and is now the coach again, to say that I was going to make my debut against the West Indies, which was like amazing. I mean, it filled me with complete dread and fear, but at the same time, unbelievable experience. And yeah, did okay then, and then kept my place in the side and played a few championship games. And that was pretty much the end of my first class cricket for a variety of reasons. But no, in that first year, it was incredible.
Yeah, sometimes when I speak to coaches in the club game, a big theme will be about how we help players transition from playing their junior cricket to then open age, and that's fraught with enough difficulties. But to have that transition whilst you're doing it in a professional setting,
quite hard for the layman to get their head round. Was there any perception from you at that early point that there was something not necessarily, I suppose what I'm trying to say here is, was there any perception that it was a special situation that you were in and that it was unusual? And how did that affect you? Was there a thought that you perhaps had, because you played so young, that had meant that you made it? Or did you appreciate at the time that there was still a lot more that could be coming afterwards?
Yes, it's a really good question. The first year was a whirlwind. I'd gone from being a schoolboy cricketer to suddenly playing first-class cricket. And I had no fear. No fear because I was naive to what was going on, I think. And it was quite a blissful existence. I just turned up at the time. I mean, I always thought I was going to be, if I was going to make it, I was going to be a genuine all-rounder. But being 16 as an off-spinner, I kind of got into the side as an off-spinner. The ball was coming out really nicely. Things just happened, and I suppose I got lucky, and I was working hard. But I had no fear at all. I had no I didn't know half the people I was playing against, so I didn't know their history or their backstory. It was just like turning up and playing cricket. But it was the next year, and everyone talks around like second season syndrome, and it's hardly like I had a brilliant first season, but I'd tasted first team cricket. That's when I actually really struggled. I struggled because there was a certain weight of expectation, I think, because I'd done relatively well and I was young. And probably I was young and immature and got caught up in it a little bit. And I began to have this real sense of a fear of failure, which I never had the year before. And I never really managed to shake that. I wasn't open about it. And I didn't talk to anyone about it. But I just began to really overthink it, I think, and overthink the opposition. And whereas the year before I just played with, yeah, great freedom and just loved every minute of it. And the really sad thing, sad reality looking back, is that I think I began to enjoy it less because I was just inside my own head the whole time. And I put a lot of pressure on myself, but I just didn't react to that very well, I don't think.
Mm. And it would be no surprise if this was the case, but being so much younger than everyone else in the dressing room and in the squad, was that a barrier to being able to deal with the turbulence in your second year? Is that there's perhaps no one obvious to speak to about it? Would that be fair?
Yeah, yes, I think so. I mean, there were some really strong characters in that dressing room. And when I mean strong leaders and people that really looked out for me. Luke Sutton was one, Graham Welsh was another, and Mo Sheikh, who had all had really, you know, at that point, successful careers in county cricket. I mean, you know, Luke still had a long way ahead of him, but Graham was maybe coming to the end, as was Mo. And they were fantastic. They really put their kind of arm around me and looked after me and kind of showed me the way. But I was in the first team and around the first team a lot in my first year, but I wasn't in my second year. And so I felt maybe a little bit more out on a limb. But I don't think my age was the thing that caused me the problem. I think it was actually my the fact that I wasn't comfortable for whatever reason in seeking the help that I probably needed. You know, it was easier just to carry on and think that everyone must be going through this, and which they do, of course, but cricket's played upstairs the majority of the time, and you know, while I was still training really hard and everything, my mindset, I can now see my mindset wasn't right. And I was still at school, so I would always join, you know, I'd do pre-season, I would train through the winter with them, but then I would go away to school and then I would come back in the summer. So I was always kind of on the outside a little bit because, you know, you're not with the squad the whole time. And I wasn't alone. I mean, there were three or four of us on summer contracts at that time. And Yeah, it was amazing. It was a great experience, but I can now look back and see the mistakes that I made. And while I don't, you know, I don't necessarily regret them, because I've managed to at least have the awareness that I got something wrong and I'm very happy with my life now, there's still always that little part of you that curses yourself for not having made more of the opportunity that was there, because it was a great opportunity and maybe I didn't capitalize on that as much as I should have done.
Okay, yeah. Now, it's not just the perhaps declines in form or the issues around managing the step into first class cricket mentally that characterized the next kind of phase for you. As you move towards retirement, which wouldn't be the thing that we'd be thinking of at this stage, what else was going on which led you towards that?
Well, I mean, retirement's very kind. I lost my contract. I was on 1 year contracts each year, which was the way with all the juniors at Derby then. And actually, that's not true. I think I signed a 2 year contract in the middle, but I was on a 1 year contract when I got released. I suffered an injury. I slipped I had a bulging disc in my back, but my head was all over the place by that point. The changing room was maybe a little divisive at that time. There were some characters in there that clashed, and I kind of got my I somehow was caught up in some of the politics that were going on in the second, more around the second team actually at that time than within the first team, and I just completely I put up barriers for myself to try and what I wanted to do was be a professional cricketer more than anything else, but I can look back now and see that I didn't work hard enough in those final years, and I had such a fear of failure that I created this mask of being laissez-faire and not caring, which is a really prevalent thing when you are feeling under pressure. It's easier to brush something off and think that, you know, it doesn't matter, because what you're actually doing is giving yourself a security blanket that if it does go wrong, you can say, well, I never cared anyway, and I definitely did that, and I can look back and see that I didn't commit to my rehab as well as I should have done. I probably could have started playing again better or earlier than I did. The truth is I did pretty well in the second team when I came back from injury, but the writing was already kind of on the wall, and because I'd seen the writing on the wall, I'd kind of prepared myself for being released. I think I was fortunate. I had 1 year left at university up at Durham, so I could continue to commit to my studies, I suppose. And when you get released, no disrespect to Derbyshire, or certainly Derbyshire at that time, but when you get released from Derby or maybe a couple of the other counties, there weren't that many options, and it wasn't like other clubs were knocking on the door trying to get me to come and play for them. So I could have gone and trialled, but I for whatever reason, I made the decision to kind of walk away and call it a day and try and find something else. And, you know, I think at the time that was the right decision, because I think I'd done the damage 2 or 3 years before by not having kind of kicked on and maybe not worked as hard as I should have done.
Right, yeah, and I was hesitant to, yet whether I was going to use the word retire, because that does conjure images of someone very consciously at the age in sport of perhaps their late 30s, or in industry of their probably in their 60s, then, you know, putting their cards on the table and saying, this is me done, and looking back on this body of work to say, this is why I've decided to retire. In sport, so often the terms are dictated, and I've been fascinated by how that's dealt with when we're really wanting to have as much in our life that we can control and that we have agency of. But in this, it's in your case, from what you've said, a mixture of physical injuries, but also the way it had been approached in other ways. So how long after did it take you to reorientate yourself and say, I'm now no longer just a former professional cricketer, I'm now into to being identify myself as something else?
Yeah, It's a really good question. On one level, I disassociated myself from it immediately, but that was on a superficial level. On a slightly deeper level, it probably took me quite a long time to actually process it. I think I, for whatever reason, I kind of bottled it up and I just put it in a room and shut the door on it. And again, continued with this theme of, well, I didn't want it anyway, so it doesn't really matter. And to the point where I probably began to believe that myself, but I can now see that wasn't the case. So it probably took quite a while to get over it, I suppose, because, you know, as all young aspiring cricketers, it's you kind of dream to be able to do that as your job. And I don't think I fully appreciated what it meant to not have that as your job. But then, as with everything, I kind of got dragged along into something else. I decided to pursue a career in law, and suddenly that became my focus to do that. And it probably wasn't really until, you know, a good few years later that I could see that I actually took the time to reflect back on my time playing cricket, because I was still playing cricket once I got released. I played a handful of minor counties games. I came down to London. I was at law school, and I played club cricket and things down here for a few years. But I just lost my love of the game a little bit, I think, which I've now very much got back. But I just, unfortunately, probably don't have the time to properly commit to playing it anymore. But I've never followed cricket as closely as I do now, I suppose.
It's another recurring theme that those who are heavily involved or closely involved with this sport, I'm sure it's the same with others, can generate this fatigue, both physically and, of course, mentally, regarding how taxing it is and all the different ways it tests you. I recall speaking not too long ago to a county cricketer towards the end of his career who was reflecting on some of the lower points in his career, whereby he'd be in a county second 11, away somewhere, so in a hotel or a guest house, in a place where he'd never been before and probably wouldn't have chosen to go to had it not been for the fixture being there, and willing it to rain so that they wouldn't have to play the next day. And I recounted that story to friends who like myself, are club cricketers and look forward to it at the weekend. And a couple of them just couldn't believe it. And then I was just trying to grope around for what the parallel is in terms of their professions, and if people viewed their profession as a hobby, would that be an appropriate link to say, you know, you would get bored of it, you would get frustrated with it. What kind of experience did you have with that? Was it even in the time that you were with Derby that there would have been games or parts of the routine that you would almost shudder to do? Or was that enthusiasm still there to keep you going?
I can say very clearly that I regularly had those days where I wished it rained. And why that is, I don't know. I think probably an element of fatigue. I mean, especially second team cricket is a really tough place to be, actually, because it's a team sport, but you're not really a team. You know, you have first teamers who have come down from the first team, who ultimately probably have been dropped. So they're striving to get back into the first team, or they're very disgruntled. You have maybe players coming towards the end of their careers who know that the writing's on the wall. You have trialists who are vying to take the spots of the people who have maybe been brought down from the first team. You've got academy guys and variety of others. And so it's a real strange mishmash. And the certainly the way I mean, it's quite a long time ago that I was playing it, but I remember it being quite a full-on calendar. And you're playing in, you're playing at club grounds. You're staying in what were at the time pretty average hotels. You're away from home a lot. It's not the life that maybe people think it is. But as with everything, if the team environment is right, it pulls everyone along on the positive, but it can also pull everyone down on the negative. And it was a difficult period. I certainly found or perceived it to be a difficult period at Derby during those times. And the second team was made up of some interesting characters. And so I definitely found myself falling into that camp of wishing it was raining, which is an awful thing to admit, but it definitely happens. And it's something I'm still ashamed of, actually, because I look at it now from the outside. I'm like, what were you doing? Like, you had, this is what you wanted to do. But you do get, you know, and I was still very young and obviously very impressionable. And I probably played along to that a little bit. And therefore got sucked down by the way that some people were acting. But on the same token, I had this crippling sense of fearing failure. And so actually it was easier for it to rain than it was to go out there, face the music and potentially fail. Which again, I really now wish, having gone through the things I've gone through later in my life, I wish I had sought help with that and just had, have used the channels that were there to talk about how I was feeling, because they were there. I just didn't choose to implement them.
Mm. Was it when you say those channels to talk were there? Where's the balance? Was it that there was an explicit understanding in a playing group that this is something that you could talk appropriately with perhaps a psychologist or even the chaplain or someone like that in the club? Or was it left implied that that was something there? And it can be a really tricky thing to navigate for management in any industry about how much you place on that, because there's always the worry of, well, if we open this up for everyone to talk about it, are we going to have everyone saying that they're not able to cope, and how do we deal with that? So how was it at that point? Did you consciously know that you could have done that, that it was an option, people did it, or was it implied and not in the domain where you could realistically make use of it?
It's probably somewhere in the middle, to the truth. There were channels there. The PCA were even back then brilliant at having, can't remember what they called them, like they were kind of performance lifestyle coaches that and they were always there, and I think always at the end of the phone if you needed them. And there were a couple that looked after the area that we're in, so that, because there are quite a few counties in and around our area with Leicester and Notts, so there was definitely the potential there to find help. Was it something that was openly talked about? No, definitely not. And, you know, for right or wrong, I imagine the changing room at Derby now is a very different place to the one that it was when I was there. And as I said, because I would come in halfway through the year and things, I always felt a little bit on the outside. So you always feel like you're fighting the system a little bit. But look, I put sole responsibility on my inability to deal with that. I put that on myself. I don't put that on the county or the individuals that were there at the time. Far from it. You know, it was my own. Yeah, it was my own problem, and it was something that I should have had the courage to. I didn't, and you don't have to do it openly. I could have done it confidentially. I should have done it looking back, but. Mm. Wisdom and hindsight are great things, aren't they?
Oh, I know. Yeah, if I'd applied the things I know now to my, say, early 20s, then I think I'd be a cross between the Prime Minister, CEO of a multinational corporation and everything. Yeah, so that's quite right. But as you go forward then, Chris, some of those lessons that you've learned from cricket surely be very valuable for for the world of work and living in general? What have you taken the most from that period of time going into now working in the law and living a life which is very different to where you were at the age of 16?
It's a good question. Probably two things spring to mind. Three things: work ethic, resilience, and the ability to compartmentalize. So putting things in boxes and closing the door on them when you need to. Now that is undoubtedly served me well in my career as a lawyer. I'm a partner in the sports team at Sheridan's, and you know, law is a pretty competitive environment, and it's to a certain extent you're paid to be to a certain extent emotionless. You know, you're a bit of a hired gun. You're there to be the rational. You're there to be whatever somebody wants you to be. So that can be quite highly pressurized. So it definitely helped the professional. I say professional. I always feel embarrassed when I say professional environment that I was in. The fact that I had been in and around a professional cricket team taught me a certain amount about how to cope in pressurized situations, which I think served me quite well. As I said earlier on, I struggled once I got released with this kind of idea that I hadn't worked hard enough. So I definitely transformed my work ethic. And there was the resilience part. Now, they're all great in a professional working environment. Where they are not so good are in your personal and private life. And actually, the period between leaving Derby and going to law school, getting my training contract, was when I first started showing symptoms of what now has been diagnosed as multiple sclerosis. On the one hand, it served me very well in work, but it definitely didn't serve me very well in my personal and private life.
I mention to most people actually that I speak to, so there's people who avoid me in the street because they think I'm going to tell them this little anecdote. A chap called Nick Peters wrote an article for our website a few years ago. Nick was a bowler for Surrey at one point, and then after he left professional cricket, he became a psychotherapist. And unfortunately, he passed away relatively recently. And in his obituary that I read, they were talking about, I suppose, like a lot of people who have an academic background as well, they found that cricket maybe didn't fulfill all of them, and thus his route into counselling and therapy. But the article that he wrote for us, it was titled "The Paradox of Vulnerability." He was explaining in this around that winning mindset in cricket or sport on the pitch. If you can have it's so powerful. The difficulty is when people cross the white line and they carry some of those characteristics into other areas of their life and maybe then aren't willing to accept or ask for help or to admit weaknesses or frailties. Is that something that makes sense to you from your experience?
Hugely. Yeah, I mean, and it's only really recently that I have really started delving into this area. I mean, I'm reading a fantastic book at the moment by Brené Brown called Daring Greatly, which is all around this idea of vulnerability and processing vulnerability and the importance that it plays in our lives. And anybody that's listening to this, I strongly recommend reading it because it's fascinating. Fascinating as a layperson, fascinating as, you know, a leader in work, as a parent, and on every single level. I think it's a really challenging aspect of sport. You know, it is how do you train yourself, your body and your mind to be as competitive as possible. And to do that, I talk about it as being kind of compartmentalizing, but really what it is, it's blocking out vulnerability in those instances, or being able to talk yourself up to not to suppress that voice. But when you come off the pitch, that you need, I believe, you need to be more open. You need to show vulnerability. You need to accept that you are vulnerable, because by masking it, it has such a profound effect in so many different ways, in the way that you conduct yourself, in the way that you treat others, in the way that you perceive yourself, and the way that you treat yourself. So, yeah, I can fully resonate with what you've just said and the article that's written. And you know, the sport is in a difficult place because of that. Because on the one hand, you don't want, you know, I'm watching The Last Dance at the moment, and you know, you just see what a winning mentality looks like, and to curb that would have mean that Michael Jordan would not have been as successful as he was. Now, he's very fortunate because he was incredibly blessed and he had an unbelievable career. And so that maybe covers up some of the knock-on effects that that may have away from your sport. But if you're not a world beater, you may still have that winning mindset. You just don't follow through. You don't have the successes that come with it. So that then starts shining far more of a light on that mentality in your private life. But within sports, it's very difficult, I think, to show vulnerability. I think it's getting easier. I think probably professional sports teams and changing rooms are encouraging it more. I mean, there's a huge shift within the business world, I think, around what do people aspire to be as a leader now? They aspire to be approachable, genuine and authentic, and to kind of lead from the front but be empathetic along the way. And you can only do that by demonstrating some vulnerability, because it's the only way that you can really resonate with people. I think if you put yourself on a pedestal, there's immediately a disconnection there, isn't there? So I think it's very difficult for sport and for sportsmen and women to try and get that balance between the two, because on the one hand, it serves you very well in your career, but it maybe doesn't serve you so well, as you say, when you cross back over the white line afterwards.
Yeah, I've been watching The Last Dance as well. I'd imagine most people in the sort of sporting world have. It's got so much quality there. And yeah, you mentioned about Michael Jordan, and I suppose it's on a slight tangent. But the thing that really struck me, I've just finished watching the episode where that amazing 2-minute clip that's been shared on Twitter is in at the very end. And I don't know what other people think, but I got the impression that he was really, really exposing the fact of what he'd sacrificed by being this tough taskmaster for his teammates and pursuing success so relentlessly. And it seems like the players have this warmth towards him because he gave them a lot of success, a lot of joy. But I definitely go with what you say there with people who maybe don't have the success of Michael Jordan, and by definition, of course, very few can. Where that leaves you, and people who feel isolated from their teammates or their friends in whichever setting, because they're holding themselves and others to standards which others don't want to go to. And that phrase, it's lonely at the top, I think anyone who's in a position of authority or is trying to get people to do things that they would rather not can empathize with that. So it's a really interesting place to reflect on, like, where that vulnerability is, because Michael Jordan showed himself at the end of that to be, you know, this world beater, to be someone who actually, maybe as he sits in his chair years after retirement, I'm sure he wouldn't swap with his one, but having a different kind of connection with those people that he clearly, you know, Pippen and so on, he's got loads of time for. So it's fascinating to take that in all these different segues about how we behave and our mindsets and what we get from ourselves and others. I could spend all day talking about it. Chris, we came in to get in touch with each other regarding where you are now in terms of what you've set up with a very similar focus to what we do at Open at Cricket. So if we could chat about Milestone, and I suppose the reasons for it are clear from what we chatted about already, but what your motivation was to set it up, what you're wanting to do, and what you see as the future in that.
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, Milestone is a, well, we're in the process of applying to become a registered charity. It's been born out of my own, I suppose, out of my own experiences. As I mentioned briefly, in kind of 2013, 2014, I was being tested for some neurological symptoms. I was given a very strong potential diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. They couldn't confirm it as a 100% diagnosis because it takes quite a long time to do that. But I was kind of given that it's 99% this, but there's this 1% chance that it might be something else. I clung on to this 1% chance that it was anything else. I completely buried my head in the sand and pretended that it wasn't happening, because ultimately I think I was incredibly scared, fearful, and probably a little bit angry at the situation. But I chose to keep the diagnosis completely private, other than with my wife or girlfriend, as she was then, and my very closest family members, and eventually three of my closest mates. That was fine. I was able to continue to live my life. I still live a very normal life now, notwithstanding the diagnosis. But what it did was it created such a profound impact on my mental health, one which I didn't have the self-awareness to realize was happening. I was quite quickly becoming a very different person to the person that I was and I wanted to be. But I was also so deluded in the fact that I didn't think it was happening. I isolated myself from, I subconsciously began isolating myself from my friends and my support networks. I became a very insular and kind of introspective person. And ultimately, it got to a point where my wife had to kind of forcefully intervene and kind of dragged me kicking and screaming to go and see a therapist, because I was depressed, but I didn't even know that I was. I didn't believe that I needed help. I thought I was fine. But I knew there was something wrong, but I wasn't going to admit it to myself. Anyway, through that journey and through that kind of process of going through therapy and beginning to explore and work out what was going on and how I felt, I initially at least wanted to, I'd kind of come around to the idea that I was going to have to tell people that I had multiple sclerosis, and I didn't want to be thought of differently. I had this real fear of judgment, this real shame around my diagnosis. So I was going to do something which was going to be so grand and so physically difficult in an endurance event that nobody could think of me differently. That was how it started, and then it quickly morphed into being something it's what it is today, which is a far more holistic mental health charity. Because what I realized through that journey was the more that I explored how I was feeling myself, the more I communicated that with others, the more I got back from people, and suddenly there was actually a very close friend of mine, someone who's been on your podcast and contributed to opening up previously, Patrick Foster, who's a very old and good friend of mine, was one of the first people I told outside of my immediate group, because he'd just gone through what he had gone through. He was in rehab for gambling addiction, and was also experiencing fairly significant mental health difficulties, as you can imagine. Through his process, he communicated with me, with a lot of us actually, about what was going on. And he laid everything out on the table, and I went to meet him for a coffee 2 or 3 days afterwards. And I was meeting with another good friend of mine. But before he arrived, Foz and I were talking, and I had this overwhelming sense that I needed to tell him about my situation. I was like, firstly, because I could see how much pain he was in, so I wanted to be able to show that I understood on some level. I could actually empathize with what he was going through, and that real sense of isolation. And so I told him, and we kind of fallen out of touch a bit through the kind of couple of years before that. But suddenly we had, like, it was like our old friendship again, but much better, because there was no walls being put up or masks being worn. And that became a really recurring theme. The more people I told, the more feedback I got, the more people engaged with me and my diagnosis, but also opened up that they were going through something themselves or that they had done previously. And it just made me think, I'm a very regular person living what is a pretty regular life, and I was really struggling. There must be so many other people out there like that. And I saw how much of a difference it made when we were communicating and talking about it. So that was the kind of the driver behind setting Milestone up, which is all around using the power of sport to normalize the conversation around mental health. So where we are now in kind of the middle of May is that we've launched. And as a charity, we've kind of set ourselves three main aims, which is to raise awareness and educate around mental health. So a lot of kind of content and, you know, thought leadership pieces and interviews, and just, yeah, getting people and hearing their stories. The second is bringing people together as a kind of a collective. We've come up with this idea of Team Milestone, so bringing people together through various different sporting events and pursuits, again, all in the name of raising awareness for mental health and fundraising. And the third is the fundraising piece. So we're hopefully going to become a charity, but we're partnering with three other charities to fundraise for them, who are Calm, the mental health charity, who obviously you guys are in partnership with, the MS Trust, who are a specialist MS kind of pastoral care support network charity, and finally the Professional Cricketers Trust, who are the charity, used to be the Benevolent Trust, part of the Professional Cricketers Association. So yeah, I reached out to you because I had been aware of what you guys were doing for a while, and thought there were, you know, firstly inspired by the backstory to opening up cricket and all the great work that you do. And yeah, we have shared aims around what ultimately we're trying to achieve, and that's one thing that I found amazing through this process, is just how many how open and collaborative so many people are within this space, and it's needed because it helps garner the conversations and hopefully drive some change. But yeah, it's been a good journey so far, and looking forward to kind of taking it forward.
Yes, absolutely. And I try not to always just say if it wasn't for COVID, because we've got to always try and see the opportunities. But of course, you know, as soon as we get back towards normality and regular interactions being as they are, I'm really looking forward to both personally and with opening up, getting involved and supporting those conversations, and also the event side of things, because any way of, as you say, normalizing this conversation is so important. And what we've had over this half an hour, three quarters of an hour, is pretty much everything we've spoken about has been mental health, but it's been from these different perspectives. And I think if we take sport, like you've said, as the way of perhaps engaging people with it, as cricketers of whatever level, we appreciate that the game is so much between the ears, and rather than it just being something that is either a given you have it or you don't have it, looking at the skills, looking at the things that work, the things that don't work, is a great way of engaging with it. So as we wrap it up, I'd really endorse what Milestone's doing, where it's coming from, where it's going. Where would people be able to find out more information, Chris?
Yeah, so we've got a website, teammilestone.co.uk, and we have an Instagram channel, which is milestone.uk, and a Twitter channel, which is milestone_UK. Unfortunately, we couldn't get two that matched each other. But yeah, they're the three main channels that we're kind of driving our content and our messaging through. And all of the details around the initiatives and the events that we've got lined up can be found on the website, and will be pushed on the social channels. But I mean, the big one that I'm really excited about next year is we're going to do an 18-day endurance event, COVID dependent, hopefully we're able to do it by the middle of next summer. But yeah, an 18-day endurance event where we take in all 18 of the county cricket grounds, with a marathon one day and 100 miles on the bike-ish the next day, which I will be doing every day. Yet to be determined whether anyone else is going to do every day with me. But the idea is to open it up to literally as many people as we can possibly get involved to come along for a 5K, a 10K, a whole marathon, half of a bike ride, the whole day of a bike ride, 2 days, whatever it might be, to really bring the cricket community together. We're literally taking in the whole of the country, taking in all of the county grounds, and we'll hopefully be able to swing by as many club grounds as possible, all around raising awareness of mental health and hopefully fundraising a decent amount for the three charities that we've partnered with. So
well, certainly look forward to that. And I think having had the absence of cricket for even just this relatively short period of time, people's interest in connecting like that should be peaked. So Chris, thanks very much for your time. I've really enjoyed chatting with you, and I look forward to doing that again in the future as well.
Yeah, likewise, Mark. Thanks very much.